listening to KN Radio, voice of the community.
So my name is Delilah, aka Deli Bars. Listening to KN Radio.
What up, peace, peace. This is Shakira Jacara. Listening to KN Radio.
This is Marcus from One Quarter Seriously Rooted. I represent Rebel Culture. Do what you want, be what you want. I'm here with KN Radio, rocking with the best.
Wherever you are listening to our radio, thank you. We thank all our listeners. Thank you for coming to our show today. Fresh news from Africa on Radio Africa 400. Today on Wednesday, September 29, 2021. We have a very special guest today. You remember that our great teacher, Marcus Garvey, told us that, I quote, a people without knowledge, without the knowledge of their past history, origin, and culture is like a tree without roots. I repeat, a people without the knowledge of their past history, origin, and culture is like a tree without roots, unquote. That's what our great teacher, Marcus Garvey, told us. Today, we're going to listen to another great teacher of us, and we want to thank him very much because he has been doing a wonderful job in the line of what we just heard Marcus Garvey teaching us. We're having probably the most prolific historian of his generation, Professor Gerald Horn. Professor Gerald Horn teaches history. He's the most professor of history at the University of Houston in Texas. His research has addressed issues of racism in a variety of relations involving labor, politics, civil rights, international relations, and war. He has also written extensively about the film industry. Professor Gerald Horn, in addition to teaching, has written extensively. You name it. There are many of his books. Let's just give the title of some of them. On Paul Robeson, the title is Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary. Another book is Race to Revolution, the United States and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. An excellent book that I will advise, I will recommend all the families to have. And we are, as we're entering the season of the end of the year, Christmas, this is the time to offer books. We have to offer books to educate our people because it is in the book that we can learn. And we have a great writer, a great historian on the history that's giving us most of our past. And I can quote another book. Another book is Negro Comrades on the Crown. And this one that I love very much is Confronting Black Jacobins. We will have the time to talk about all those books. But we will have the time also to give you fresh news from Africa. And when we talk of Africa, we talk of global Africa, not only the Africans in the motherland, but global Africans around the world. We have Africans all over the world today. In the United States, of course, in South America, we will talk about Brazil. We have in Haiti. We have in Asia, etc. But before that, I want to welcome our guest, Professor Jura Horn. Thank you, Professor, for taking your time to come to our radio. Thank you very much. How are you doing today?
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Yes. Thank you. We will be talking about some of your books. And if you mind, we'll start by giving some news from Africa. We know that things have been going on in Africa these last days, whether in Ethiopia, where unfortunately a civil war is going on there with the Tigray trying to secede. If we have time, we will talk about it. We'll talk also about a coup d'etat that took place at the beginning of this month on September the 5th in Guinea, when the former president, Alpha Conte, had been overthrown. And we still have the situation in Mali. We had a first coup d'etat in Mali. We have a coup d'etat in Mali, and then you have a second coup d'etat. It was the first coup d'etat in May. So we will talk about all these things. But, Professor, coming back to you, you have heard this quote from Marcus Garvey. What do you think of it, and how could it be useful to us today? May I repeat the quote?
Well, I mean, obviously the quote is important, and I would say this is particularly the case for people of African descent in North America, because obviously what happened with regard to the African slave trade is that people were uprooted from their homeland, and there was a systematic attempt to erase any knowledge of that homeland, a systematic attempt to deprive the uprooted of their language, systematic attempt to deprive them of their culture. And so I would say it's particularly incumbent upon Black people in the United States to try to recuperate by working overtime to recover what has been lost. And this is not just for the sake of history, it's also for the sake of struggle. Because right now, we're at a very desperate moment here in the United States of America. You probably heard of the new book by Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward and his colleague Robert Costa called Peril, which talked about how about 9 months ago, the 45th U.S. president did not want to turn over power to Mr. Biden. And the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, which we all saw as it unfolded live, was an attempt to prevent the turning over power. But also, what some of us did not know was that he also wanted to accompany that with a strike, a military strike against China, so that he could then declare a state of emergency and retain the reins of power. Now, military strike on China could have meant the beginning of a nuclear war. A nuclear war could mean the extinction of all humanity on planet Earth. So these are the stakes that we're faced with. And given the high stakes, it's incumbent upon us to gather all the ammunition we can, with that ammunition including a detailed understanding of how we got to this point, which would, of course, obviously involve the detailed understanding of our history.
Thank you very much. We will go straight, direct, and thank you for this answer. We will go directly in one of your books. And I very much like this book. The title is Confronting Black Jacobins. First of all, why do you use this title?
Well, Black Jacobins, you may recall, was the title of a book written by the Trinidadian writer C.L.R. James. It remains today, even though it was published decades ago, probably the most profound analysis of the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, and it's very important for Black people in particular, but I would say all of humanity, to be aware of the Haitian Revolution, because what happened with the overthrow of slavery in the Caribbean was not only the establishment of the first independent Black Republic and the abolition of slavery, but then, like revolutionaries anywhere and everywhere, the Haitian revolutionaries sought to spread their gospel, including in North America. There's a direct relationship between unrest of the enslaved in North America and the Haitian Revolution. But more than that, the Haitian Revolution ignited a general crisis of the entire slave system that could only be resolved with its collapse, which it began to do in North America in 1865. So one of the many reasons why Black people in North America are not officially slaves, at least, is because of the Haitian Revolution. And that's why we owe an eternal debt of gratitude to the Haitian revolutionaries. And that's also one of the reasons why the Haitians are treated so atrociously on these shores, as you just witnessed on the Texas-Mexico border a few days ago, because there is a lingering hatred and animosity towards these Haitians who had the nerve to overthrow slavery, to kick out the enslavers, and to chart an independent path. And that's why I was so heartened to see so many Black people in the United States object to the horrible treatment that was visited upon these refugees at the Texas-Mexico border, because we owe a debt of gratitude to Haiti that can never be repaid.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We will come back to that. For the moment, I would like the historian to speak. You know, we don't know our history. And when we have someone like you, knowledgeable of all these facts, it is important for ourselves, for our children, to set the record so that we know what happened and what were the consequences. We will come back on the what is happening. For the moment, I would like, please, if you can set the stage and explain what happened during this Haitian Revolution, and to explain how a group of Black people were able to defeat the most powerful armies on earth at that time, France, Great Britain, Spain. If you can just give us some glances of what happened so that we can measure the exploit of what these people have achieved and how they were organized.
Well, I think what they would do is, in Haiti, the Black people in Haiti, they would play off one power against another. For example, when they were battling France, they would ally with Britain. When they were battling Britain, they would ally with Spain. When they were battling Spain, they would ally with the French. And see, that's a lesson that I'm afraid to say that many of our leaders in North America do not necessarily understand. That is to say that one of the reasons why Black people in the United States are doing so terribly is that most of our leaders or organizations, they don't have a global analysis. They have no understanding of how you try to play off one power against another. Either A, they don't have a global understanding, or B, they just basically echo whatever U.S. imperialism is up to. So if U.S. imperialism doesn't like the Soviet Union, we don't like the Soviet Union. U.S. imperialism doesn't like China, we don't like the China. But if the Haitians had taken that approach, there'd probably still be slavery, not only in Haiti, but in the United States too.
Okay. On the ground, you see these people organized to defeat France. And they were fighting Napoleon's army. And at that time, quite enough large area of land of what is the United States today belongs to France. Can you tell us what was the consequences of Haitian and Toussaint Louverture defeating Napoleon on the USA?
Well, you know, let me clarify something. Oftentimes it's said that when the Haitians, when black people in the Caribbean defeated Napoleon and his French troops, that Napoleon decided to throw in his cards and sell what was considered to be the Louisiana Territory. That's the territory starting at the mouth of the Mississippi with New Orleans, stretching all the way up to the Canadian border. But the amendment I would make to that, and that's a commonly held perception. I recall when I was doing research in Haiti, people were telling me the same thing, is that we should say the French claimed this land. It actually belonged to the Native Americans, quite frankly. And then what happened is that the French were trying to liquidate, exterminate the Native Americans so they could take over that land. They were then followed by the United States, which sought to liquidate, exterminate the Native Americans so they could take over that land. So obviously the United States succeeded, which is one of the reasons why, even though 2 centuries ago, that territory was teeming with indigenous folk, with people we would call American Indians, now they're mostly gone because they were all killed. And so that's the amendment I would make to that commonly held perception.
Now, can you tell us, Professor Hall, what was the consequence on the black slave in America of the victory of their cousin in Haiti?
Well, number one, not only the black slaves in North America, or the enslaved Africans in North America, I should say, not only were they inspired to try to duplicate what the black people in Haiti had done, that is to say, to get rid of slavery by engaging in mass uprising, but also the Haitians had the good sense to try to make global alliances. Well, first of all, let me say that with the Haitian Revolution, you saw that Britain, which was the major power, they realized the jig was up because Haiti was trying to spread its gospel into neighboring Jamaica, which was a British possession. And Britain decided a few years after 1804 to give up on the African slave trade because they were bringing Africans across the Atlantic. It was basically just bringing more grave diggers who were seeking to bury the slave system. And then a few decades later, in the 1830s, they decided to give up slavery altogether. And that was basically at the instigation of the Haitians. And so what happens is that after Britain decides to move away from slavery, Britain and Haiti then join together to put pressure on the United States to do the same thing. And that's what I mean about having a global alliance. I think that ever since the 1950s, when you had U.S. apartheid, which was then called Jim Crow, it began to retreat, not least because of global pressure, this time from the Soviet Union and the socialist camp, which was supporting African liberation movements. The United States was trying to appeal to these African liberation movements and Caribbean liberation movements, found it difficult because black people in this country were treated so horribly. So the United States decided to throw in the towel with regard to Jim Crow, at least to retreat from the more horrible aspects of Jim Crow. So what you see is that both slavery and its close cousin, Jim Crow, were all driven to retreat because of global factors. But I think what happened post-1950s is that many black people in North America forgot those basic lessons. I can't think of any black organization today that has any consistent understanding of what's going on in the world. If you don't understand what's going on in the world, you can't understand what's going on in the United States. And if you don't understand what's going on in the United States, no wonder so many of our brothers and sisters are in jail.
Okay. Thank you very much. The chapter 6 of your book, the title is U.S. Negroes and Black Jacobins. You're covering the period 1830 to 1839. I find this chapter very interesting. with a lot of information. I don't know if it would be possible to read just an excerpt of that chapter so that the listeners can hear and listen to you, and they will be they know that the value of this book, and they will be ready to purchase it or to offer it.
Well, first of all, I'll defer to you. Tell me what you want me to read.
No, I want the opening of the chapter, the two opening paragraphs, the one on the broadly transformative slave revolt by Gustav. Yes.
The broadly transformative slave revolt led by Nat Turner in Virginia in 1831 persuaded some pro-slavery defenders to believe that the Haitian Revolution had descended on the shores of North America. One scholar argued that the mainstream press in the Commonwealth of Virginia inadvertently propelled this idea, since it was easier to focus on bloodshed emerging from the Caribbean than in its own backyard, even when obliquely referring to the charismatic leader of slave rebellion. Nat Turner remained unmentionable because of the Caribbean menace his very name was thought to have foreshadowed. Now, that's the first paragraph of chapter 6 on
yes.
54. Let me add the point that a few years ago, a black filmmaker by the name of Nate Parker made a movie about the Nat Turner slave revolt that I recommend to your audience. It's called The Birth of a Nation, not The Birth of a Nation that came out a century ago.
Yes.
It was made as a counterpoint, as a refutation of that century-old Birth of a Nation.
A wonderful movie.
It's quite transformative, and if you have not seen it, you should consider yourself to be deprived.
It is a very, very well-done movie. I remember that. And I will advise our listener to try to see this movie. And it is important in this first paragraph that we have just read, we've heard about Nat Turner. What do you think of him, and how should the black people today assess his action?
Well, Nat Turner is a black American hero. He led the most significant and profound uprising against enslavement, which took place not that far from Baltimore, speaking of Virginia. He liquidated a number of slave owners and their families as well. This was quite intimidating to the entire slave-owning class. And I think it's fair to say that with the Nat Turner slave uprising, you basically saw a turning point, because what happens is that the slave owners recognize that slavery comes with a very stiff price, that you can not only lose your life, you could also lose your investments, which many would consider to be even more important. So that's why we should continue to uplift the name of the great Nat Turner.
Thank you. We will come back to him, to it, but we will have a break now. And after the break, we'll be back with Professor Horn. You're listening, I remember, I recall you, we're here with Professor Jura Horn, our guest today on our show, Fresh News from Africa on Radio Africa 400. So we go into a musical break, and after the break, we'll be listening again to our Professor Jura Horn. thank you again. You're listening to Radio Fresh News from Africa. Today we have our guest, Professor Gerard Holmes at the University of Houston, Texas, a brave historian, a prolific writer, and we are really pleased to have him. We were talking about his book, Confronting the Black Jacobin, and we just heard an excerpt from chapter 6, and we're talking about Nat Turner. Let us continue with him. You know, he says he's a hero. How can he inspire the younger generation today?
Well, I think he inspires the younger generation today because he was fearless against overwhelming odds. Many of our black youth feel that they face overwhelming odds with regard to confronting well-armed police and behind them well-armed military. Nat Turner faced a similar overwhelming situation, but that did not stop him. That did not deter him. The only footnote I would add with regard to today is that I think that our youth today, who have been able to be put in a more advantageous position in 2021 than Nat Turner was in 1831, need to take advantage of that advantageous position by arming themselves more adeptly today than we were armed in 1831. What do I mean by that? I think our youth today should learn languages other than English, for example, so that we can communicate with our brothers and sisters across the planet who may not speak English. I think that our brothers and sisters, our younger brothers and sisters today, should be part of organizations that meet on a regular basis, that have a structure, that are struggling to improve the plight and plight of black Americans on a day-to-day basis. I think that our brothers and sisters today should be engaged in the kind of militancy that helped to define the Nat Turner we know and love today.
Yes, just taking on what you just said, a militancy. What type of militancy? I'm thinking about, here we have to address and to speak to the young generation about how to organize, how this militancy will be structured. And I'm happy to hear that we should add a language issue here to learn a different, a foreign language in order to be able, since you have said at the start, using the strategy that the Haitian revolutionary used, an understanding of the global action on the global forces and actions. So how this can we organize the young people in terms of the militancy so that it is efficient, giving the tools, the technology, and the knowledge that they have today?
Well, to cite one example among many, I do interviews on a radio station in Los Angeles. And a few weeks ago, I interviewed a young sister from Baltimore who's part of an organization called Black Alliance for Peace. And one of their programs focuses on the Baltimore police. As you may know, the Baltimore police, along with police across the United States, they oftentimes receive military materiel from the Pentagon, from the U.S. military. That's why when you have nonviolent protesters in the streets, at least in other cities I've seen in the United States, you often see the police in tanks confronting a nonviolent protest. That's because of this program that police departments get where they can get a military warfighting material that you would think only be used in the streets of Baghdad or the streets of Kabul, Afghanistan. So this organization in Baltimore is campaigning and has campaigned successfully to make sure that the police do not get this kind of Pentagon materiel. In order to do so, they have campaigned internationally. They have put pressure on the United States by going to the United Nations, which is a global body. Recall that many of our leaders, past and present, have either talked about or actually have gone to the United Nations. That includes Paul Robeson, Malcolm X, and many others. And they have been relatively successful with that kind of militancy. So that's the kind of militancy that delivers. It's the kind of militancy that propels us forward and puts us in a better position to help to erode, if not overthrow, the system of oppression that now entraps us.
Thank you very much. As you have mentioned, the United Nations, where is the eyes of the world, the stage of the world, and you rightfully mentioned that some of the African-American leaders were there. We remember that just last month, August the 31st, 2021, was declared the International Day of People of African Descent. This is the first time. And let me quote what the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, said. I quote, "This day is a celebration of the enormous contributions of people of African descent to every field of human endeavor. It is a long overdue recognition of the profound injustices and systematic discrimination that people of African descent have endured for centuries and continue to confront today." Unquote. That is what the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, said to inaugurate the first time, for the first time in history, this was just August the 31st, 2021, the International Day for People of African Descent. Here I have two questions to you, Professor. First of all, would you please comment what the UN Secretary General has just said? And what do you think of this International Day for People of African Descent?
Well, I think that the day is a step forward. What you need to realize is that there are about 54 different countries in Africa with sovereignty that are independent. In the United Nations as a whole, there are about 190 different countries. The Africa bloc is one of the most significant blocks numerically in terms of the United Nations. And therefore, the African bloc then can wield influence in many different organizations. Look at the World Health Organization, for example, which has oversight in terms of dealing with the pandemic, which has kept many of us inside and has killed many more of us. The World Health Organization is headed by Dr. Tedros, who happens to be of Ethiopian or Tigrayan descent, for example. I recall some years ago, as a journalist, I traveled to Namibia, which was then in the process of becoming independent after being occupied illegally by South Africa. Namibia is an independent country today. It was not when I traveled there. One of the things that struck me when I arrived in Namibia, which was then being administered on a temporary basis by the United Nations, was that so many of the United Nations workers there were Jamaicans, Trinidadians, were Ghanaian, were Kenyan, etc. Because what happens with regard to the United Nations is that every nation gets a quota in terms of the jobs in these various organizations, like the World Health Organization, for example. And what that means is that these Africans who have influenced the United Nations, if we were to reach out to them, they could wield influence on our behalf. For example, just a few weeks ago, September 7th, 2021, an event happened that passed basically without notice in Black America, sadly enough. It was a summit, a virtual summit between the African Union, which incorporates the independent African nations headquartered in Ethiopia, and the Caribbean community, speaking of Jamaica, Trinidad, Barbados, etc. It was a virtual summit, but speaking were President Kagame of Rwanda, President Kenyatta of Kenya, President Ramaphosa of South Africa, Prime Minister Motley of Barbados. They made a joint Pan-African agenda that includes many issues that would be of significance to our community, such as reparations for enslavement, But as I said, most of our community didn't even know. I'm talking about the leaders and the organizations and the intellectuals. They didn't even know that this meeting even took place. And as long as we have that kind of nonfeasance, that kind of ignorance of what's going on in the world, it's no wonder that we're in so much difficulty and trouble.
Now, you have mentioned the African Union and the United Nations. As we're speaking, we just have the General Assembly of the United Nations. And again, rightfully, you mentioned and you said that the African bloc is the largest. But they may be large in numbers, but they don't have any weight in the decision. You know, the five permanent members are there. The African Union has been asking for a reform of the United Nations that really reflect their weight in terms of demography. I don't know if you are aware of it and if you can say something to our listener about this issue.
Well, the United Nations, headquartered in New York City, reflects the events ending with World War II in 1945.
Correct.
Those two on the winning side, which would include the United States, Great Britain, France, the then Soviet Union, and China, not necessarily communist China, that comes later, they set up a system whereby they would have the ultimate say with regard to the United Nations. However, I think it would be going too far to say that the African bloc has no influence. Once again, I'm glad we started with the Haitian Revolution. We're talking about slaves who played off one power against another. Oftentimes, you can have independent African nations do the same thing. And fortunately, what happens is that sometimes they're successful in playing off one bloc against another. The problem, in terms of speaking to this Black American audience, is that too often the Black American audience, they decide to take whatever position the U.S. State Department takes, as I said before. The United States State Department doesn't like the Soviet Union. The Black Americans don't like the Soviet Union. The only difference is the Black Americans come up with their own spin. They don't like the Soviet Union because they say it's, quote, racist, unquote. If the United States State Department doesn't like China, Black Americans say they don't like China either. And they'll come up with their own stance. They'll say it's because they're, quote, racist, unquote. So as long as you have that sort of primitive, backwards approach to international affairs, well, what little leverage we have cannot be exercised, cannot be executed, and we dig an even deeper hole for ourselves.
Yes. And where can we find an alliance here whereby the African Union, because they have been putting forward a number of claims for reform. They call it the Isuzuni reform. That was the common position presented by the African Union on the reform, meaning that, for instance, they want to extend the number of seats, permanent seats, to have 2 seats for Africa, because it is quite understandable that a continent like Europe, whose population is around one-third that of Africa, they have 3 members, permanent members, those who have decision, 3 out of 5, namely France, UK, and Russia. The 2 other permanent members being China and the US, of course. How is it that a continent of 1.3 billion people, that would be 2 billion by 2050, do not have any permanent seat there? So they have a claim in terms of permanency. And my question was, how could we build an alliance between the African Americans and the African Union of Africa to advance this claim so that at least they could have a seat also, and it did, making the United Nations a stage that can discuss African American issues?
Well, point number one is that the African American organizations, leadership, and intellectuals have to recognize that this is an important issue. That's point number one. We haven't even gotten there yet. Point number two, then they would have to take that issue and make it part of the platform of political parties that they vote for. And then point number three, they would have to, Black Americans would then encourage the African Union to then align with other powerful blocs and nations that are not represented in the Security Council. I'm speaking of, for example, Brazil, India, perhaps Japan, and then make an alliance with all of those powers to then put pressure on the five permanent members. Now, that's very easy to articulate, but the problem is execution. Naturally, as they say, the trip of 1,000 miles begins with one step. Also, trying to get to where we want to get with regard to reforming the United Nations begins with an understanding that this is an important issue, which we have not gotten to yet, I'm afraid to say.
All right. Thank you. So we hear what you say regarding the Ezulwini consensus. This is how the African called the position. Ezulwini consensus position of the African Union looking for some permanent seat. And I think there is a ground for work between African Americans and African, at least the official Africa, meaning the African Union, so that they can work together to advance this topic. We will go to another break now, and after that, we'll be back with Professor Moore, who is our teacher today. He's teaching us history, he's giving us information about how to understand not only the world today, but to take the understanding from the past, because we always know that today is the consequence of the past, as tomorrow will be the consequence of today. So, please stay with us. We're having a musical break, and we'll be back with Professor Horn. Thank you. Thank you very much, dear sister, dear brother, dear family. Thank you. Good afternoon, good morning, wherever you are on the earth here today. Thank you for listening to our radio, Fresh News from Africa, from Africa 400 Radio. Today is Wednesday, September 29th, 20 and 21, and we're very happy. We are privileged to have with us today our guest, Professor Gerald Hall. We've already talked about one of his books on Haiti. We'll talk about other books. But now, we will come back to some important issues that he mentioned at the start of this show relating to the former president. And we saw what happened on January the 6th, and it's not all. It seems that it is continuing. We have the movement now called the J6 Rally. And I would like Professor Holmes to explain to us, giving his history, his understanding of this movement. How can you explain it? And what is the outcome? What can we expect from it? And how should the Black community behave?
Well, this so-called J6 movement is very dangerous. I mean, basically, they're trying to downplay the significance of what happened on January 6th, which was an attempted overthrow of the U.S. government to keep Mr. Trump in power indefinitely. And they're trying to act as if that was not the case, although we all know that that was the case. I think that the worst case scenario, the worst case projection of what might happen, although the J6 folks would not mention it, and I say this with all seriousness, I say this with utter seriousness, that the worst case scenario could be a return to slavery. Now, I know that that might sound outrageous, and I'm sure that many of the young people would start talking about, oh, you know, they're not going to enslave me. Okay, fine. Now, they'll kill you. But that's the ultimate scenario. The intermediate scenario would be a worsening of the already terrible conditions. If you look at what's happening in the jails and the prisons, that's a form of slavery already. That's where a number of our brothers and sisters wind up in any case. And you could see an escalation, an acceleration of that process if these J6 folks get more influence and power. Which brings us, once again, back to where we began, which is what is to be done. I think that immediately, if not sooner, we need to light a fire under our organizations and intellectuals and leaders to begin reaching out global, from Wade Mpume is the congressman from Baltimore, for example. He should be encouraged to be in touch with his counterparts in the Caribbean community, in the African Union. The NAACP, for example, has very close contacts in Baltimore. At one time, they had their headquarters in Baltimore. For all I know, it's still there. They need to be encouraged similar, because I think it's fair to say that we're in a state of emergency right now. A poll suggests that Mr. Trump plans to run for re-election. Given the fact that voter suppression is taking place, voter suppression means that if you go to the polls to vote, your name will not be on the list and you'll be turned away. However, Trump supporters will be allowed to vote. So there is a real danger that in a few years, Mr. Trump will be returning to power. So I say to the brothers and sisters within range of my voice, if you care about your children, if you care about your family, if you care about yourself, then you need to start acting upon the seriousness of this dire situation we're now confronting.
I may say what you have just said is quite scary, Professor Hall, because you have given us two scenarios. One is what you call extreme scenario, return to slavery or to a form of slavery. The second one being the escalation in case, of course, this is a hypothesis, in case the G6 rally movement extends. But what is the responsibility of the current administration, given the role that the black people played in the election of President Biden and Vice President Harris? What is the responsibility of the administration facing this situation?
Well, the responsibility of the administration, of course, is very high. They have a high responsibility because even if they come for us in the evening, they'll come for Mr. Biden in the morning. And if he's intelligent, he'll realize that. But I think that he has certain constraints. However, our organizations, our leaders, our intellectuals don't have the constraints. The way that politics works in this country is that the political leadership in Washington will act if they're forced to act. If they're not forced to act, they will not act, which will basically mean not only our demise, but their demise. And so in some ways, the responsibility rests on our shoulders to be proactive, to be militant, to be aggressive, to be smart, to be intelligent, to be global, to be international, to be radical.
Yes. I'm happy that you casting the responsibility on our shoulders, and in particular on the intellectuals. You are one of those intellectuals. You are a prominent intellectual. How, as of today, how is the state of Black American intellectuals facing this type of topics? What is the landscape?
Well, I would say the landscape is not very promising, but I would say it's the same for Black leaders and Black organizations as well. The intellectuals only reflect the organizations and the leaders. I think that there's not enough militancy with regard to Black intellectuals, even in terms of their job. Their job is to deal with ideas and to put those ideas into permanent form in terms of books and articles in particular. I would say that they have not been terribly productive in that regard. They haven't been producing as many books and articles as they should be. Let's not even talk about the quality, which I don't think has been very high. And even in terms of just speaking, it doesn't take that much to speak on the radio or a podcast. You just have to be prepared. I do interviews myself for this radio station in Los Angeles. I can't tell you how many Black intellectuals have turned me down. I only ask them to come on and talk about their work. They don't even want to talk about their work. I don't ask them to talk about the United Nations or the African Union. Or I ask them to talk about what they get paid to do, which is, I don't know, to write biographies of feminist heroines or whatever their intellectual preoccupation is. So the short answer to your question is that Black intellectuals are lagging behind, but then again, so are organizations and leaders as well.
But among the Black intellectuals, there is a brand which is called the Black conservative intellectual in America. And they are very prominent, they are very active. We hear some of them in the mainstream media. What is your analysis about this movement, this fact that started, I think, in the 1980s during the Ronald Reagan administration? What is a Black conservative intellectual, and what is his motivation? And how should we, or the Black population in general, react facing them?
Well, the Black conservatives generally or sellouts. And this is nothing new. I mean, if you want to understand, and I've written about this at length, why more slave revolts in North America did not succeed, usually what happened is that the slave owner was able to buy off one of the enslaved who would turn in the rest of them. And the Black conservative intellectuals, in many ways, are the descendants of those sellouts who sold out slave revolts. I won't even distinguish them by mentioning their names. They get too much publicity as it is. And I'm afraid to say you have a few of them right there in Baltimore who are acting similarly, although I will point to a black conservative who considers himself to be an intellectual, Larry Elder, who was just trying to become governor of California. He's a Black man. You know, he's melanin rich, as they say. And his positions were just horrible. You know what his position is with regard to a minimum wage? He said the minimum wage should be zero. Now, you have people who are struggling to push the minimum wage past $15 an hour to $20 an hour. I'm confident that maybe within the next few years, if things go right, the minimum wage will be $20 an hour. You could work at Wendy's or McDonald's and come home with a $20 an hour paycheck. He says it should be zero. Fortunately, he was defeated at the poll because zero minimum wage, that means you work for free, I guess. So this is what we're up against.
Yes, you had just mentioned this, the recent election in Los Angeles with Larry Elder. This is a prominent, we hear him on different radios. He's on mainstream media. He has a position that we know. But I just want to ask this question really very simply. He's an epitome of the Black conservative intellectual in the USA. I wonder, what exactly does a Black conservative conserve? Can you tell us?
Well,
because if we see the white conservatives, they are conserving wealth and power. If you have to conserve something that is beneficial to you, or that you already possess, or your community possess. So I can understand a white conservative, they have the power, they have the wealth, they have the resources, either individually or as a community. I want to understand, what does a black conservative in America conserve?
He's conserving his own well-being or her own well-being. I mean, for example, look at Candace Owens. The sister whose name escapes me, who ran against Kwesi Mfume for Congress, she's suing Candace Owens right now. And I wish her luck, because Candace Owens is a black woman conservative. She's married to one of the richest men in the world. He happens to be a white man. And so when she spouts the gospel of black conservatism, she's well-positioned. She's not thinking about a larger black community. She's thinking about herself. I guess she's maybe thinking about her family. But she's not thinking about the rest of us, that's for sure.
Okay. Let us come back to Haiti now. And I interrupted you in the beginning as you were trying to talk about the prison situation and what we saw on the border. Because to start, I wanted you to set the historical significance of Haiti for black people around the world. Let us look at the current situation and see how the Haitian immigrants are treated. And coincidentally, this is happening at the same time that the USA is opening its arms widely to the Afghans. So what is your take on this contrast, this difference of treatment?
Well, there are many reasons. Number one is the history that I just recounted to you. There's a lingering hatred, animosity, and sympathy towards Haiti because they helped to overthrow slavery, which then led to slavery disappearing in the United States. When slavery disappeared in the United States, billions of dollars in property and capital and money went down the drain because the slave owners were not compensated. So there's this anger towards Haiti. And then, of course, U.S. corporations are involved because a few years ago, the Haitian government was trying to raise the minimum wage in Haiti to 61 cents an hour. Corporations like Levi's and Hanes objected. They wanted the minimum wage to be 31 cents an hour. And if you're in Haiti and you can earn 31 cents an hour, and if you can get to the United States, you can make maybe $15 an hour. Well, if you care about your family, you're going to try to get to the United States of America, because 31 cents an hour is almost next to slavery. And so you have a number of corporations who want to drive people back to Haiti. They don't want them coming to the United States. They want them to stay in Haiti, not only work for Levi's and Hanes, but baseball. When the Baltimore Orioles go out into that field down near the harbor in Baltimore, the baseball team, the baseballs are made in Haiti at 31 to 61 cents an hour. So there are powerful forces in this country that are wanting the status quo, what exists today, to continue. That's one of the reasons why you have these atrocities on the border.
But is it possible just to stay on the side and watch the atrocities going on? What can be done?
Well, I think what happened, if you'll notice, is that area under the bridge in Del Rio, Texas, which about 8 days ago, there were thousands of Haitians there. They're no longer there. Some were sent back to Haiti. About 12,000 have entered the United States of America, although I understand that thousands more are on their way. What happened is that many black leaders began raising their voices. Mr. Biden heard their voices because his future is dependent upon the black vote. And so that's why you have 12,000 more Haitians in the United States today that were not here 8 days ago.
All right. This is a concrete action, and that gives us a result. We hope that it will continue like this, and that we have more actions, and we have commitment and engagement of the African intellectuals writing books, writing articles, formulating ideas to prevent the rise of the movement that stormed the Capitol on January the 6th, and that seemingly is amplifying under the J6 rally. We've heard the opinion of Professor Hall. We will take another break, and we'll come back to him with more to hear, more to read on history, on topical issues concerning the black people around the world. Let us have this small musical break. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you again, dear sister, dear brother, dear family. Thank you to be our listener, to listen to our show today. We have with us Professor Gerald Hall, who teaches history at the University of Houston, Texas. We've seen what Haiti, we'll talk about the UN, we'll talk about the August 31st, that was the first time we had the International Day of People of Africa Descent. And now we're going to continue our program with looking at the southern part of America, in particular Brazil. We know the black presence in Brazil is very important. We don't know much about them in history. We don't know more about what is happening there. But what is sure is that to what we have read and listened to, the pandemic, the COVID pandemic is devastating people there. And given that they are in a very bad situation and the health system is not conducive to the progress, there are a lot of suffering going there. We don't have the death toll on the black community there, but it looks like it is important. I don't know, Professor Holmes, if you have anything to say about it.
Well, first of all, with regard to Brazil, what black people in the United States need to know is that whether you know it or not, you probably have relatives in Brazil. That's because during the days of slavery, there was a link between slavery in Brazil and slavery in North America. These were the two largest slave societies in the Americas. And black people were like cattle or horses. That is to say, you could be a so-called black American one day, and you could be sold into slavery in Brazil the next day. Not only that, but slavery ended in the United States in 1865. What happens is that many slaveholders in the United States of America, they acted like heat sweat. Make it last forever. And so they wanted to make slavery last forever. Slavery in Brazil lasted until 1888. So they immediately left with their so-called property, their slaves in tow, and moved to Brazil. So it's highly possible that black people in North America have relatives in Brazil. Today, Brazil has the largest black population outside of Nigeria. It also has some of the same problems that we face here in North America. Problems of high mortality concerning the coronavirus, problems of police terror and police killings, problems of a surging and growing right wing, which wants to turn the clock back. Recall what I said a few moments ago about how these J6 folks want to turn the clock back, possibly even to slavery. You have a similar force in Brazil. And indeed, their president, Bolsonaro, is known as the Trump of the tropics. Many of his advisors are the same people who advise Donald J. Trump. I'm speaking of Steve Bannon, who, of course, is headquartered in Washington, D.C., a stone's throw from where you're sitting, Jason Miller, and all the rest. So it's incumbent upon us to keep up with what's going on in Brazil, or at least to be part of organizations that are sufficiently serious that they keep up with what's going on in Brazil.
Yes, there are two stages here. And you have mentioned this bloodshed relation with them. And you have mentioned the fact that some African Americans in the United States, they may have some relatives in Brazil. But how is it that up to today, we haven't established really important, solid relationship in terms of organizations and community between Black in America and Black in Brazil?
Well, it goes back to what I said a few moments ago. After the United States, under international pressure, began to move away from Jim Crow in the 1950s, that's the program of U.S. apartheid, a separate cemetery for Black people by law, a separate Bible to be sworn in on in court by law. So what happened is that there was a compromise. The compromise was that in return for the United States moving away from certain aspects of Jim Crow, we would ditch our international relationship. So that it's a very simple answer. I've written books about it. I've talked about it. But what happened is that there's a certain kind of amnesia in this country. People's memories are faulty. It's almost like there's collective Alzheimer's. You know, Alzheimer's, when old people can't remember where they left their keys, and sometimes they can't even remember who their children are. Well, you have people who are 20 years old who have a kind of historical Alzheimer's and don't even realize how and why we got to this point. So that's why we don't have relations with Black people in Brazil. Very simple.
Yes, Professor Hall, I want to remind our listeners, this is a man who he's a jewelry for us because of the knowledge that he has been distributing. If I'm asking him a question about Brazil, because he wrote one of his books, is The Deepest South, the United States, Brazil, and the African Slave Trade. This is one of the wonderful books on this topic that I have ever read. Let me give a list of some, I cannot quote all of his books, but let me just give you six titles. The first one, as I said, was Paul Robeson. The title of the book is Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary. And then we saw Confronting Black Jacobins. And we spoke about another book whose title is Negro Comrades at the Crown, African Americans and the British Empire Fight the U.S. For Emancipation. There is another third book which title is Race to Revolution. I just mentioned to you The Deeper South, and I can also mention The Counter-Revolution. These are six books, and as the season of gifts is coming, I please try to buy this, to purchase and to offer these books, because we know it is in the book that we can read, we can learn, we can cultivate ourselves and give the wisdom to the next generation. Professor Hall, I don't know if you have your book, The Deeper South, in which you speak about the United States, Brazil, and the African slave trade. I would very much want, if it were possible for you, to read an excerpt. And then after that, we will talk about the issue of reparations.
Well, what page? What page do you want me to go to?
Take any page. I know this is a wonderful book. I have read it many times. And I know that wherever page I open, I learned that is important of the book that you read, because every page is a lesson to us. It empowers us to read. So just choose yourself one page that you think would edify our listeners.
Well, this is from page one. I'll just read the second paragraph. This book argues that U.S. slavery is better understood in hemispheric terms. The slave South, which includes Maryland, that's me speaking, sought in an alliance with Brazil, a formidable hedge against a future relationship with the North. And for that matter, a hedge against continuing pressure from London and Haiti to abolish slavery, a hedge that could mean triumph in a civil war if need be. In other words, there was this distinction, as you know, between the North and the South in the United States. Most of the slaves were in the South, Maryland, Virginia, the Carolinas, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas, etc. Slavery was financed from the North, particularly New York and Boston. But that contradiction ultimately led to a civil war, as you know, in which slavery was defeated. The slave South thought that if they could ally with the slave owners in Brazil, they could defeat the North and perpetuate slavery forevermore. Just like today, as I mentioned a moment ago, Bolsonaro, the president today of Brazil, is in close relationship with Donald J. Trump. They have some of the same advisors. They feel that together they could turn the clock back. However, the problem is that our movement, our community, is not aligning with or allying with our natural ally, the black people in Brazil, which I'm sure is good news for Donald Trump.
All right. As you're talking about Brazil and that time, I have in mind the fifth president of the United States, James Monroe, who elaborated the doctrine. I would like you, if possible, to come to this doctrine because it is very important. We know that he was president from March the 4th, 1817 to March the 4th, 1825. And during these critical issues, he took a number of measures relating to the southern part of America. It will be interesting, if it's possible, Professor Horn, to remind us who was this man and what role he played.
So James Monroe is a Virginian, a slave owner. He devises what's called the Monroe Doctrine, which is that the United States fundamentally can order affairs of any nation in this hemisphere, Mexico, Brazil, Jamaica, Barbados, Trinidad, Guyana, which is ridiculous, obviously. Actually, what the Monroe Doctrine was intended to accomplish was to say that after Britain abolished slavery and the slave trade, that they were not allowed to be involved in this hemisphere because of their anti-slavery approach, and that this hemisphere should be dominated by slave owners. Now, that's not what he said, but that's not what he meant, but that's what he meant. And the fact that there's this discrepancy between what he said and what he meant should not be as a surprise to any of us, because we know that politicians today, oftentimes they say one thing and mean something else altogether.
Yes, he started his term in 1817, just a little more than a decade after the victory of the revolution in Haiti. What was his position relating to Haiti? Which Haiti was already an example, and how did he react it?
Well, like most U.S. presidents, he despised Haiti. He hated Haiti. But what's interesting is that that begins to change a little bit with the U.S. Civil War, because what happens is that Haiti was one of the few allies of the Lincoln government. That is to say, the government headquartered in Washington, D.C. And Haiti helped the Lincoln government to overthrow the rule of the slave owners. If you go to Haiti today, you'll find that one of the main streets is named after John Brown. John Brown, in 1859, tried to lead an armed overthrow of slavery in what is now West Virginia, then Virginia, and was executed as a result. He was seen as a hero in Haiti, which is why to this very day, a major avenue in Haiti is named after John Brown.
Now, let us talk, as we are going to the close, about the issue of reparations. What is the state of the battle for reparation in the United States today, and what must be done?
Well, compared to 10 years ago, there have been advances. That is to say, reparations for the free labor that Africans supplied to build the United States, which, of course, there have been advances. Say that again?
Sorry?
Oh, did you say something?
No, I didn't. I didn't say anything. Go on. We're listening to you.
Okay, so reparations is the compensation to the descendants of enslaved Africans who provided free labor to build this country. That includes, I would imagine, a good percentage of your audience. Now, where does it stand today? Well, in terms of the bill that's in Congress, it seems to be stymied. However, what's happening is that you're having reparations on a local level, because it doesn't all have to come from Washington, D.C. What I mean is that in a number of cities, like Evanston, Illinois, Asheville, North Carolina, even the state of California, there are attempts to provide reparations. I think it would be quite appropriate for Baltimoreans and Marylanders to devise a citywide and statewide movement for reparations, because Maryland was a slave-owning state. You had slaves in Baltimore up until the 1860s. So it would be quite appropriate for those within range of my voice to immediately begin to push for reparations.
But I would like to know your take about the official movement. I think in the Congress, there was something, they were talking about reparation in the Congress, in particular with the Black Caucus. What do you think, and what can we expect from them?
Well, that's what I mean when I say Washington. There's a bill in Congress, but if people have been listening to me, they should come speedily and readily to the conclusion that there is progress with regard to abolishing slavery, with regard to eroding Jim Crow, and I would also say with regard to gaining reparations that are meaningful to the extent that we are engaged globally and internationally. And right now, I would say that reparations in Washington probably are not going anywhere because there's not enough international pressure. And to the extent that groups like Black Alliance for Peace, which has a chapter in Baltimore, and I mentioned them a moment ago, to the extent that they're active and to the extent that their efforts can be duplicated across the country, to that extent, reparations becomes more problem.
We have some of our listeners who are calling, and they are listening to you very carefully, and they would like you to comment, to tell them more about this movie that you mentioned at the start. I think the 2016 movie on the Ned Turner life, which was the birth of a nation. Can you give some elements that would push people to go and see this movie?
Well, sure. It's very enthralling. First of all, it deals with an important chapter in our history, the Nat Turner slave revolt in Virginia, 1831. It's a dramatic portrayal of that. It's not a documentary. It has a plot. It has a narrative. You may recognize the name Gabrielle Union. She is one of the stars. you may recall that she happens to be spouse of the former NBA star, Dwayne Wade, who formerly played for the Miami Heat and the Chicago Bulls, amongst other teams. So I recommend it. Look it up.
Let us recall that the director of this movie is Nate Parker, N-E-T-E. And the movie is about the story of Nat Turner, N-A-T. Do you have any similarity between the hero, the hero after whom the movie is written and the director? Do you know anything about that?
Well, I know, I happen to have met Nate Parker. He's a very progressive person. He's a very concerned person, committed brother, a young brother. And I just think it's a coincidence that he has the name N-A-T-E and he's doing a movie about N-A-T.
Yes. So to our listener, let me recall the title of the movie. It is The Birth of a Nation. Do not confound it with another movie with the same name that is of the past century. But this one, this is a 2016 film, The Birth of a Nation, with the director, Nate Parker, based on the story of Nat Turner. We will end, we are going to end, I will ask you about the final questions that I will ask you now. We are here in a program called Fresh News from Africa, and we want to link Africans globally. As an African-American intellectual, as a professor in a prominent university, what is your view on the African continent today?
Well, once again, it depends upon your starting point. I mean, compared to 1960, we've come a long way. And I'm very optimistic about the African continent. As you probably know, within a few decades, perhaps 1 in 4 people on planet Earth will be of African ancestry. The African Union has a continental free trade area. They're trying to develop a one economy in Africa, which is something that Kwame Nkrumah, the late Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana, suggested decades ago. And so I would prefer to be upbeat about Africa, despite the many problems, not least being COVID, not least being the proliferation of military coups, such as one that just happened in Guinea-Conakry, not least being the rise of the so-called Islamic State in northern Mozambique and in other parts of Africa, and its spawn, such as Boko Haram in northern Nigeria, which is infiltrated into Niger, Cameroon, and elsewhere. But despite those problems, I'm upbeat.
Hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes. Have you finished?
Yes. Despite those problems, I'm upbeat. That was my last one.
Yes. As a people, we are the people, our black people. You mentioned many times during this interview the absence of communication. We are here to build link. And you build link on a civilization. This will be the most solid link that will bring us together. If we were to talk about a black civilization in today's world, first of all, is it possible to talk about it? And if not, how do we need to build it?
Build what? Say that again.
A civilization. This is what people are linked, are related through civilization. What do you think? Is it possible to speak today in the 21st century about a black civilization in the world, or are we going to build it, or what do you think about it? The concept of civilization relating to the black people.
Well, it depends on what you mean by that. I mean, I mentioned a moment ago how the African Union and the Caribbean communities, peoples of African descent, separated by the Atlantic Ocean. They're trying to build bonds.
Yes.
So if that's what you mean by civilization, sure. I mean, it's happening as we speak. But that term civilization, it's a slippery term. I'm not really sure of what it actually means.
I would like you to define it if you want. If you are.
Well, no, it's your term. You define it and now.
Okay. I'm not going. You are the intellectual. I'm not an intellectual.
I would not use the term civilization. That's
okay. What term? That's a culture. Would you want us to use culture?
Well, I mean, I think we could talk about a common economy, for example.
Yes.
With common exchange.
Yes.
In the continental free trade area of African Union, which is now trying to build a common economy with the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I guess that could be the basis of what some people might call a civilization. But civilization, I don't know. It's not a term I ordinarily employ.
Okay. So I would think to the term culture, because as I was reminding this quote from Marcus Garvey, he said that people without the knowledge of their past history, origin, and culture is like a tree without roots. That was, I was relating, I wanted to hear your comment about the contribution of the black people to the culture of the world and how they can continue with their creativity in this regard. And you've heard what the UN Secretary General said about it as he was inaugurating the International Day of the People of African Descent. Last question, Professor Horn. If you had a wish, what would that be today for black around the world to rebuild their link, in particular thinking about the youth?
Well, that's a huge question. Obviously, we would have to presuppose the overthrow of U.S. imperialism. But more specifically, I would like to see the black youth, once again, to reiterate, to learn different languages so that we can better communicate. I would like to see more reading done amongst our youth. I would like to see more learning of different musical instruments with regard to our youth. I would like to see more of our youth learn how to do coding with regard to producing software for computers in order to execute ever more sophisticated tasks. I mean, I could go on and on in this vein, but I think it's good to do it.
I thank you very much, Professor Jura Hall. I hope that our listener have appreciated this masterclass that you gave us today, the masterclass of history, an important moment in the history of our people. I hope that they have appreciated your vast culture, whether in America, in Haiti, in Brazil, in Africa. You have offered us very important answers to the question that we ask you. And we thank you. We know that you're very busy in your teaching, in your research, but you accepted to come to radio. Dear brother, dear sister, dear family, we are coming to the close of our show now. We thank you very much. We will end as we started and as we're reminded by this quote of our great teacher, Marcus Garvey, remind it, of people without the knowledge of their past history, origin, and culture is like a tree without roots. Professor Horn has just given us all necessary not to forget our past history, not to forget our origin, not to forget our culture. We thank him very much. We will see you next time in the next program. Thank you. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Bye-bye. Zombie when I want way, Joro Jara Joro. Zombie when I want way, Joro Jara Joro. Open your hands, stand up.
your hands and start the things falling, fall out. Oh! Order. Attention, quick march, slow march, left on, right on, back on, double on, salute. Open your hand, stand the things, fall in, fall out, fall down, get ready. Attention, quick march, slow march, left on, right on, back on, double on, salute. Open your hand, stand the things, fall in, fall out, fall down, get ready. Hot! Order! One more time, everybody.